This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at BFL in Switzerland, and I will be your host today. Today, we'll be talking to Julie Berwald about the new book, Life on the Rocks, Building a Future for Coral Reefs. The story of the urgent fight to save coral reefs and why it matters to all of us. Life on the Rocks is an inspiring, lucid, meditative ode to the reefs and the undaunted scientists working to save them against almost impossible odds. Well, Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So can you tell us, what do you do?
I am a science writer, and I write books mostly about the ocean. My first book was about jellyfish and, hang on a minute. I don't know how to turn that off. Oh, well, okay. Hopefully you can edit that out. I'm sorry. My first book was about jellyfish and sort of the, as I looked into the world of jellyfish and what was happening to them, I discovered just the amazing science of jellyfish. But they also reflected back on us a lot of the problems in the ocean, some of the things that are happening with climate change, with ocean acidification, with coastal development, and not taking care of what's in our seas. And so that book was a really exciting for me to write. It also was, the subtitle is The Science of Jellyfish and the Art of Growing a Backbone. So I had to switch from being a scientist, which I'm trained as an ocean scientist. I got my PhD in satellite imagery of the ocean, to being a writer and stepping into that, those shoes, and finding my voice as a writer and a little bit as an activist, because there's a sense as a scientist, or there has been a sense as a scientist, that you should stay out of policy. I think that's switching now, and we can talk about that later. But that book was really my first big foray into saying, here's what I see that's going wrong in the ocean. And jellyfish are my muse to be able to help explain that story. My next book is called Life on the Rocks. And it is a story of coral, and coral are sort of, and we can talk a lot more about this, but coral are at this critical place where they live very close to their thermotolerance. And as our oceans warm up, it's a really critical time for oceans. But as I was telling the story of it's a really critical time for coral. But as I was telling the story of coral, I realized there was this sickness in my own home, with my daughter suffering from mental illness. And so these two stories become intertwined. And this is, again, something that I feel really strongly about, that science is not just an abstract, objective thing, but it actually is a process that humans undertake. And as such, our emotions are part of the results of the science. They aren't part of necessarily the outcome of experiments, but they're definitely part of how we interpret the scientific answers that we discover. And so I ended up winding the story of my struggle to be a mother of someone who had mental illness struggles with the struggles of what was happening to coral on our planet. And I feel like this way of telling science seems to touch people. And I find that important and powerful and something that I love exploring.
And what got you interested in ocean?
It's a funny thing. I grew up in Missouri, which is the center of North, of the United States, like almost as far as you could get from an ocean ever. And I think as kids, we did go on a few like vacations to the beach, but I never snorkeled or stuck my head underwater until I was in college. And I went on a study abroad program to Israel. I was pretty miserable on that study abroad program. I just didn't fit in with the people on my program. I was unhappy. And there was a sign on the side of a building and it said marine ecology course over winter break, sign up here. So I signed up because I wanted to get away from where I had been in Tel Aviv. So they put us on a bus and we went down to the Red Sea, to the town of Eilat, which is on the Red Sea. And basically we got off the bus and they threw a mask and a snorkel at all of us and some fins it's a very abrupt kind of Israeli, like no instruction way, just like get in the water. So I did. And it was like, I mean, it's kind of trite to say it, but it really felt like that scene in The Wizard of Oz when she opens the door into Oz and suddenly the world is in color. And I felt like that, like I put my face in the water and I was on this magnificent coral reef and there was so much going on. There were fish and urchins and sea stars and there was this coral which had created these like castles and they were so many colors and shapes and forms. And I couldn't believe, first of all, that these were all animals, that this wasn't a forest where plants are the base of it, but animals were the base of it. And I felt like, I can't believe I live on the same planet as this incredible world that I had no idea existed here. And it changed me. It changed everything for me. I finished that course and I said, I want to be a marine biologist, which I know sounds silly. Like a lot of people say that, but I really did. And so I got myself into a bunch of marine ecology internships to try to give myself some more basic knowledge about biology. And eventually I got into grad school, but I wasn't accepted into any labs that were working on coral, which is really, really what I wanted to study. And instead, I had been a math major as an undergraduate. So I got into a lab that was working on some mathematical algorithms for satellite imagery of the ocean. And I studied phytoplankton. And at the time, we knew already that carbon dioxide was changing our planet. Like this was the 90s. And it was very clear. Scientists had established that carbon dioxide holds heat and we were pumping carbon dioxide into our atmosphere from burning fossil fuels. But the question was, how much is the ocean buffering for us from that? There's a ton of phytoplankton in the ocean that perform photosynthesis. So they take up carbon dioxide and mix it with water and light and make sugar. But what is the amount of that? We didn't know. So that's what I was working on. And it was the first time we had these satellites that could look at the ocean and show us just kind of how green the ocean is, which is a proxy for photosynthesis. And so it turns out that about between a quarter and a third of the carbon dioxide that's emitted from fossil fuels is absorbed by the ocean. And so we are, we benefit from this photosynthesis that's going on out in the ocean. But even more important than that, about 90% of the heat that is held by carbon dioxide in our atmosphere is transferred into the ocean. So the oceans are disproportionately absorbing the heat that we are adding to our atmosphere by burning fossil fuels. And if we didn't have the ocean, we would be in much worse shape than we're in right now. So that's where my dissertation came from. And that's kind of the story of how I got interested in the ocean.
And you already mentioned you had very interesting pathway in your career when you switched to science writing. So can you just tell us how easy or difficult was it?
Yeah, I didn't know that I wanted to be a writer. In fact, the reason I was a math major in college was because I got really intimidated about writing. My roommate in college just happened to be a fantastic writer, brilliant. And I read some of her writing in the first weeks of college, and I thought, I could never write like that. That's so intimidating. So I literally just became a math major so I wouldn't have to keep up with someone who was a brilliant writer like her. I said, I'm never going to write another thing. I'm just going to do math equations. Which, looking back, was really a waste of opportunities to have professors help me become a better writer. But I became a math major, and I said I was never going to write again. And then I got my PhD in something that was pretty mathematic. But then I fell in love and got married, and my husband wanted to move to Austin, Texas, which is where we still live. And so I did have a postdoctoral fellowship, and I brought it with me to the University of Texas. But during that postdoc, I realized I was really not that great at math either. I wasn't that great at pushing forward these algorithms on my own. And this is true. I was in a yoga class, and I was really contemplating whether I should continue to be a scientist or not. And there was a woman in the class who was working at this textbook company, and it was really innovative. It was all online, and it used lectures that were video lectures, and used like cartoons and graphics to tell the stories of science in these textbooks. And I thought, wow, that seems kind of cool. So I applied and got a job there. And that's where I learned how to write. Because working in textbooks, you have to learn how to use words really efficiently and to never waste a word. You don't have that much space, and you really want to be as clear as you can. And I also got to learn how to be creative, because we had all these animators who worked with us. And I loved it. I loved telling science stories in ways that were interesting and fun and creative. And I realized like that was what I wanted to do. And so then I started slowly to write stories for magazines. And then eventually, you know, I made this big decision to write books.
And what would you say to our student listeners and maybe early career researchers that might be contemplating sort of the path that you've taken?
Practice writing. So I had let all my writing skills go really, really rusty during grad school and during college, really. And it wasn't till I started practicing writing that I learned how to do it. So in those years when I was still working at the textbook company, and I worked at a couple different textbook companies. And then when I was writing magazine articles, I started writing a blog, and I don't think blogs are very cool anymore, but I'm not sure about that. I actually still have the blog, so I don't know if anyone reads it, but I did commit to writing a blog every month, and publishing it on my website. And I found the practice of finding like one story that I found really interesting in the science world, and then turning it into something that I thought other people might want to read and that would be entertaining, really good practice. And I committed to like publishing once a month. And, you know, I'd be sometimes writing on like July 31st at 11:51, like trying to finish it, even knowing no one may read it, but just committing to doing that once a month was great practice. And I think in doing that, I learned to find a voice that I found interesting myself. You know, I've practiced being funny and and practiced being a little heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching. I practiced, you know, writing with emotion about things that were scientific. And so that's my biggest advice is practice. And if you can practice with someone else, that's also a good thing. I also joined a writing group and we would meet every Monday night. And each Monday, someone would submit one piece of writing. And my, and that was another great way to practice because I was not only forced to submit once every 6 weeks, there's six people in my group, but, you know, I got to read other people's work and read it critically and try to come up with constructive criticism for them. And that's a great way to learn as well.
Oh, that's an excellent advice. Okay. So your latest book is The Life on the Rocks, Building a Future for Coral Reefs. So let's dive in. Oh, sorry for the pun. Let's dive
in. I love
into
the pun. It's great.
And can we start with a very basics to make sure that everybody is on the same page? So could you describe what exactly are corals?
Yeah. So coral are amazing. They're animals, like I said, and they're really a way to picture it is a sea anemone or a jellyfish turned upside down. And those are actually a coral's first cousins. So they're all part of this group called Anthozoa, which means flower animal. And they're very ancient forms. They only have two cell layers. We have three. So we have an endoderm, which lines our gut, and exoderm. It's not the right word. Endoderm, but sorry, I screwed up there. But anyway, we have an outer skin layer. And then we have a mesoderm, which holds all our organs. Well, the coral, jellyfish, and sea anemones don't have that middle layer. So they just have two cell layers. So they're very basic animals. They also don't have a full gut. They have one hole that's surrounded by tentacles and that acts as their mouth. They take their food in, they sting it with stinging cells. And these stinging cells are just absolutely phenomena of the biological world. They are little capsules, which have sort of a wound up weapon tubule inside. They have a little trap door that opens when there's a plankton nearby. And then the weaponry fires out of the stinging cell at 5 million times the acceleration of gravity. So if you can imagine dropping a pen, you know, down onto a table, that's 1G, that's the acceleration of gravity. But the stinging cell fires 5 million times faster, which is the fastest motion in the animal kingdom that we know of. And I just did some fact checking on this, so I know it's true for a story I wrote about jellyfish. And so jellyfish, sea anemones, and coral all have these stinging cells. It's what unites them in this phylum called Cnidaria. But back to their kind of anatomy, their tentacles are lined with stinging cells. They can fire at plankton, and then those stinging cells are poisoned as well. So they immobilize the plankton and then they move it into their mouth along their tentacles. Then it goes inside and it gets digested, and whatever they can't digest comes back out their mouth because they only have one hole. And then they also have, similar to us, they have nerves, they have a digestive system, they have, they have ways of sensing the environment, the chemicals in the environment. There's possibly even light sensors in the jellyfish and sea anemones, probably in the coral. So they have a lot going on, just like we do. What makes coral so special and sort of differentiates them from the other animals in their phyla is that they have teamed up with an algae. And so they, when they're quite young, they'll eat some algae, but rather than digest it, they move it into their digestive tissue that lines their guts. And then the algae live there for their whole lives. And the algae do what algae do. They photosynthesize and they take carbon dioxide and water and make sugar. And then they feed 90% of that sugar to the coral animal. And that is an amazing fuel source. It is so much energy that the coral can then take that energy and use it to take calcium and carbonate out of the water and forge that into limestone. So then the coral create these limestone skeletons outside of their bodies, outside of their little kind of polyp bodies. And those limestone skeletons become the great coral reefs of the world. And so, and I should say this, coral polyps usually live, not all of them, but most of them live connected together into colonies. So it's like a bunch of sea anemones that have glommed together and they share, they can eat plankton and they do eat plankton and they share that nutrition among the many polyps, but they get really most of their energy from the algae that live in their tissues and then they build these skeletons around themselves for protection. And then those skeletons form these great, brilliant architectural wonders that are the coral reefs of our planet. The interesting thing, there's a lot of interesting things, but one of the interesting things is that because the coral rely on the algae, they have to live in sunny places. And so they tend to live in the tropics, which are the sunniest places on our planet, and have the longest day lengths. And they also have to live shallow in the ocean because the ocean, the water itself absorbs light. So we tend to get coral reefs surrounding islands or on the top of like underwater volcanoes or mountains. And so that the coral can live close to the surface of the sea. And the coral reefs, so they're in sort of a band around the tropics and they only take up less than 1% of the ocean's area. But because of these incredible architectural complexes that they build, they provide homes for 1/4 of all marine life. And it's really hard to know how many species that is because every time we look in the ocean, we find new species. And the oceans are just they're very poorly explored. But, you know, I've seen numbers between 250,000 to 800,000 species that rely on the coral reefs for some part of their life. So a disproportionate part of our planet's life depends on the coral reefs. And so they're extremely important at ecosystems, maybe the most diverse ecosystem on our planet.
So you mentioned this word holobiont, if I pronounce it correctly. So what's that
holobiont
mean?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So what does that mean?
So yeah, because of this intricate relationship between or intimate and intricate relationship between the coral and the algae, it's very difficult to talk about the coral animal without also talking about the algae that supplies so much of its energy. And so scientists started talking about this holobiont, which means the whole creature, animal and plant combined. And when you talk about coral and actually animal, plant and mineral combined, when you include the coral's skeleton that it builds. So yeah, so this holobiont is a more complicated and sort of nuanced way to refer to the coral and acknowledging the fact that so much of its energy comes from the algae. And yeah, one more thing I didn't mention is that the places where coral live are these tropical parts of our planet. And because of the oceanography of our planet, those places are really nutrient poor. There's not a lot of nutrients. And what I mean by nutrients are fertilizer. So you can think of places that have a lot of nutrients as like a jungle forest where there's lots of leaf litter on the floor and that gets broken down by bacteria into the fertilizers that then the trees use to grow. So that would be a nutrient rich place. And then a nutrient poor place would be like a desert where there's not a lot of organic input coming in. So the same thing is in the oceans, and the deserts of the oceans are the tropics. And that's because the ocean is sort of a two-layered system. The surface layer is where the sun is, because like I said, the light doesn't permeate to the depths of the ocean. So that's where the phytoplankton are. But then when they die, or when everything dies in the ocean, it sinks down to the bottom, which is the deep layer. And that's where bacteria work on it and break it down into nutrients, into its fertilizer form. So that's nitrogen and phosphorus mostly that we care about. And there's no way to really get that nutrient-rich water from the deep water up to the surface where the phytoplankton need it to grow, except for ocean currents. And because of the way that ocean currents work, these places called upwellings, they mostly exist in the temperate regions. And that's why a lot of temperate regions are where we find the biggest fisheries. But in the tropics, there's not a lot of upwellings. So they're very nutrient poor. And the way, and this is kind of part of what makes the algal coral symbiosis so cool, is that the algal waste products, which are nitrogen and phosphorus, can be fed directly to, the coral's waste products, which are like pee, I guess, which is nitrogen, can be fed directly to the algae, which needs all that nitrogen in order to grow. Yeah. And so they've shrunken the whole ocean's circulation system to just being within that single little animal plant symbiosis. And so the coral wastes go to the algae, which it needs in order to grow. And then the coral photosynthesizes and gives its sugar to the coral, which it needs to grow. And so they've solved the problem of this nutrient poverty by teaming up. And then that became the great coral reefs of the world. So the holobiont, if we consider it as this incredible algal coral symbiosis, we really have a better understanding of what the coral are doing out there. And so it's a really useful way for scientists to think about it.
So what are some of your favorite coral reefs around the world?
Well, that Red Sea, the Red Sea reefs are, it will always have a piece of my heart, because those were the first ones I saw and the first place I saw that great diversity. And they, you know, it's really cool because they, and I actually don't even talk about this in my book because there just wasn't room to talk about everything, but those reefs could be some of the last surviving reefs on our planet. They are preconditioned to handle warmer temperatures because the Red Sea corals arrived there kind of recently, and they had to pass through a period of real warming in order to establish themselves in the shallow seas. And so it turns out they're really thermally tolerant. I guess one of the things I haven't talked about yet is that when the seas warm by a degree or two for an extended period of time, this incredible symbiosis between the coral and the algae breaks apart. Mm. And we still don't understand exactly why, but the algae will leave the coral. And we don't even understand the trigger. Like, who says, is it the coral saying, I'm warming up, I'm not feeling good, I'm feeling stressed out, I don't have the capacity to deal with anything besides myself right now. And it feels this infection sort of by the coral, by the algae, and says, get out. Or is it the algae that is kind of like, it's warming up, I'm not being fed as much nitrogen as I usually like to be fed by the coral, and this is not a good place for me to be anymore. I'm gonna alert the coral's immune system that I'm here and get kicked out, because it's better for me to be out in the ocean than in this coral that's clearly getting sick. So we don't know which of those two things is happening, but that's the big problem for coral around the world right now. And we can talk more about that. That's called coral bleaching, because when the algae leave, they take their color with them, and the coral is left looking clear, just a clear piece, thin two layers of tissue on top of this white skeleton. And so the coral are bleached. They also lose their nutrition that the algae used to feed them, and they start to starve. So if the symbiosis can't be reestablished, the coral die. But in the Red Sea, one of my favorite reefs in the world, the coral are a little more thermally tolerant. The coral symbiosis with the algae seems to last a little bit longer. Also, it is pretty far north as far as reefs go. And so it's possible that Red Sea Reef may be one of the last reefs on our planet. Another really amazing thing is that the next IPCC International, what does it stand for? Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Mm-hmm. The next meeting will be in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, which is just on the edge of the Red Sea, where these incredible corals and coral reefs, they're really diverse. There's probably 400 species of coral that live there. So just miles away from that reef, people will be deciding on the future of coral reefs. So they're actually in a very interesting place politically in this moment as well. Let's see. Other reefs I love are, the Coral Triangle. The Coral Triangle is this place between Indonesia, the Philippines, and Papua New Guinea. And it's not exactly a triangle, but it's kind of a triangle shape. And that is the highest diversity of corals in the world. So somewhere around 600 or 800 species of coral live there. And it's magical. It's just an incredible place where the coral are vibrant and colorful and beautiful. And you just see something different every time you dive on those reefs. And then the last place to mention is probably the Great Barrier Reef off of the east coast of Northern Australia. And that's the largest barrier reef. It's the largest reef on our planet. It's actually made up of 3,000 smaller reefs. It's 1,400 miles, so something like 1,800 kilometers, 1,900 kilometers long. And for comparison, it's the size of Italy. And it's so big, you know. You have to almost remind yourself that these small little coral polyps and their algal symbionts created it. That they built it up, you know, molecule by molecule. It's bigger than anything we humans have ever built. It's just this massive structure that you can see from space. And so just for its very the existence, it's definitely on my favorite list.
So then how does the unhealthy reef look like? And what kind of challenges are the reefs facing nowadays?
Yeah, so climate change is definitely the number one challenge. I described what bleaching is, and bleaching happened to coral throughout history. If there was sort of a low tide and the coral were exposed to more of the sun's radiation and warmth for, you know, a tidal cycle, scientists observed that happening in the early 1900s. So that probably happened over time. But there was never the kind of, it was more like, oh, this would happen, almost like, you know, we would get, us humans would get a flu or something, you know, it's something that would happen, but you would recover. But for bleaching to become kind of pandemic, meaning it would happen on like a regional scale where all the corals would bleach, or almost all the corals would bleach on a regional scale, we never ever saw that until the 1980s. And then it happened again in the 90s. And that's when scientists started to be alarmed. And then it happened again around 2006 and 2010, 2012. And basically, since around 2016, we've been in a state of constant mass bleaching where huge swaths of reef will bleach. And so, as I said, the ocean has absorbed 90% of the heat that we've emitted, or that carbon dioxide has been holding as we've been emitting more and more carbon dioxide. And so the oceans have already warmed roughly a degree, almost a degree and a half. And the thermotolerance for the bleaching to happen is around 2 degrees for about 4 weeks. And so we've seen more and more episodes where that's happened. And when it's unlikely there's any reef in the world that hasn't experienced a mass bleaching at this point. And the predictions are pretty bad by 2050. If we don't get climate change under control, 1% of the reefs are expected to be left. And so that's pretty dire. But I should say it's not over yet. And one of the things that scientists have been noticing is that every time there's a mass bleaching, there are also survivors. So you'll see a huge, huge swath where everything's white, but then stuck like very infrequent freckles are colonies that don't bleach. And so something's going on there. There seem to be some corals that have this kind of thermotolerance, or the symbiosis has a thermotolerance. And so there's a lot of research going on into what allows these survivors to survive. And one of the things we know already is that thermotolerance can be inherited. So if you have two parents that have an offspring and both of those parents are better at surviving at higher temperatures, their offspring will be better at surviving at higher temperatures as well. But one of the things we've also discovered is that there doesn't seem to be just a single gene for surviving higher temperatures, that it seems to be genome-wide, spread across the genome like butter, kind of across toast. Mm-hmm. So there's not like one gene we could somehow transfer to coral reef and say, okay, cool, they're going to survive now. It's more complicated than that. So that's really the biggest thing, challenge facing coral. Other things that coral are suffering from are declines in water quality. I mentioned that coral live in these sort of deserty places in the ocean where there aren't a lot of nutrients. They like it that way. They've evolved to live that way. But as we've started agriculturalizing our land, there's been more runoff of fertilizer into the ocean. And that higher fertilizer seems to make the coral sick. And so there's been an increase uptick in coral disease as the water quality has gotten, less good for corals. And so they do suffer from a lot of diseases, and that's really problematic. There's a really bad one right now that's sweeping across the Caribbean. It's called stony coral tissue loss disease. And it's really horrible. It sort of causes the coral's tissue to melt away. Mm-hmm. And a coral that's, several hundred years old will die if it gets this disease in just a matter of weeks. And we still don't know what the causative organism is, what the pathogen is. Mm-hmm. Some people have found that if you use antibiotics and sort of apply it in a cement around the edges of the disease front on the coral, as it's spreading, you can stop it, but it's not a universal treatment. It doesn't seem to work. And what's really bad about this disease is that, as opposed to other coral diseases, which maybe strike one or two or three species, this one seems to strike about 20 species. And in the Caribbean, there's probably around between 40 and 60 species of coral altogether. So it's a lot. It's a huge number of coral species that are being afflicted by this disease. And it started in Miami and it went down the Florida Keys, and now it's jumped off and it's spreading throughout the Caribbean now. And then the last thing that's really a threat to corals is illegal fishing. And we have, you can damage a reef by dragging a net across it, or there's ecosystem collapse when you take too many top predators off the reef as well. Mm. So kind of like a Jenga pile, a reef is a complex ecosystem. And if you take out some of the top predators, you have changes underneath that. And when you destabilize the herbivores on a reef, that can cause problems for coral, because coral are always competing with not the algae, the small ones that live in their tissues, but bigger ones called macroalgae for space. And so reefs can become overtaken by algae, these macroalgae, and they can really squeeze out the corals. And then there's another problem in a lot of developing countries. There's a problem with blast fishing, which is where fishermen who are driven to do so through poverty and other forms of corruption that keep them from making a fair living will use bombs to fish because it's cheaper and quicker. And that will cause huge blast scars in the reef that the coral reefs, they can't reestablish themselves on that kind of rubbly seafloor. And that was a problem I saw a lot when I was in Indonesia diving in the Coral Triangle.
Yeah, this is truly heartbreaking. So where should we focus our efforts going forwards?
I think, you know, our biggest efforts really, ultimately, the story of the coral reef is a climate change story. That is the most important thing we can do for the reefs, because if we can get the temperature of our planet under control, the coral, we can restore some of the reefs that are physically being destroyed through illegal fishing. And we can also work to deal with the water quality issues up here on land. That start up here on land. But if we don't deal with climate change, it's going to be all of these other things are going to be really difficult to have a major impact on the reefs. So, yeah, I mean, my advocacy is to let your elected officials know how important it is. And I mean, if you think about this massive ecosystem that's under threat, I mean, hundreds of thousands of species, not individuals, but species whose lives are really at risk. If we don't start dealing with climate change, it becomes a really important story and one that is largely invisible to us up here on land. And that's one of the themes of my book, is that it's really easy for us to forget about the oceans. I mean, we're terrestrial creatures. It makes sense. We don't live in the ocean, but the ocean influences us and we influence the ocean, and we are all on this planet together. We are interconnected. One of the important things about coral reefs is that because they support so much life in the ocean, they actually support a lot of life up here on land. Between 500 million and 1 billion people rely directly on the coral reefs for their major sources of protein. Their diets come from fishing. And as we're starting to see reefs decline, we're starting to see people who live near them and rely on them having to shift their diets to less healthy diets. And then with that, you have an increase in disease and malnutrition and undernutrition. And if our reefs decline, I mean, can you imagine 1 billion people losing their primary source of protein? It becomes a real humanitarian issue. Another thing coral reefs do for us up here on land is they are the best barrier against storms that protect us. Like on land, 97% of a storm's energy will be diffused by a healthy coral reef. And so like in the Bahamas, there was Hurricane Dorian. It was a Category 5 hurricane that came roaring up to the Bahamas. And the southern part of that island was relatively unscathed because their coral reef there is pretty healthy. And it diffused the energy. And people did not suffer as badly as they did in the other parts of the island where the reef had been more impacted and was less healthy. So we see examples where coral reefs protect us, like really protect us from storm damage. And storms are only becoming stronger as we heat up our atmosphere. So they're incredible and incredibly important to us.
So now thinking about the bigger picture, and I wonder if you could maybe talk a little bit more about your advocacy efforts and why is it important for us to bring forward the stories, like the personal stories of scientists, and to really get it out in the open to get people interested in issues like this?
Yeah, so I'll start with a little philosophy. A long time ago, I read a book called The End of Science. And it basically said that, you know, during the Renaissance, science and art were interconnected. And there were great strides made in art and science during that time. I mean, we think about, you know, kind of the idea of Da Vinci, you know, who was an artist and a scientist, and he progressed in both areas. And then we had the scientific revolution, and science and art got split apart, and we made great strides during that time as well. You know, science really, it improved our human health, technologies evolved, you know, our quality of life is unquestionably better in this separation of science into just its own category. But this book that I read kind of claimed that until we bring those things back together, we're going to stop making progress. And I see that happening in the ways that, especially through the recent pandemic, you know, science has been, it's been made fun of, and it's been discredited. And I think it's because science got too far away from our human emotions, and it became very remote from the lives that people live every day. And so I do believe that bringing science back in touch with art is what needs to happen in order for us to make the next leaps forward. And in my own, in the book, in it was almost like a microcosm of this. When I started writing about coral, my daughter started getting really ill, and we couldn't understand what was happening. She distanced herself from all her friends. She started failing school, like not just a little, but a lot. And she just was shutting down. And I was keeping a journal of everything that was happening to her because it was so alarming. And I was so confused, and I didn't know what was happening to her, at the same time that I was working on these stories of coral. But occasionally things would sort of like seem to amplify each other. So my daughter, one hypothesis was that she was suffering from this autoimmune disorder, and it was affecting her brain and causing her mental illness, which it turned out to be OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. And it was causing that to kind of really get very, very strong. And one of the hypotheses about what's happening to coral when they bleach is that there's an immune response in the coral, where the coral, like I said, kind of turns against itself and kicks out these algae, the algae that are its very life source. And so I started to see kind of the ways that the sickness in my home and the sickness on the reef, you know, they weren't that different from each other. There were these connections. And then as I was telling the story, I actually had the opportunity to go to Australia, to the Great Barrier Reef, to look at this one idea that they have for protecting the reef, which is called cloud brightening. And I got invited on a research cruise, and the cruise was going to leave March 23rd of 2020. In the meantime, in my home, my daughter was really shutting down more and more, and she realized she needed to go to a residential hospital to work on her mental health. And her admission date was March 15th, so just a week before. But we all remember what happened, like right around them. Oh, sorry, her admission date was March 17th. But on March 15th, we all remembered, or at least in the United States, we shut down on March 15th. And so all of these things started coming together. And then I was denied entry into Australia just after we had to drop my daughter off at this mental hospital, and everything became connected like in time, where our planet was shutting down. My daughter had shut down, and my trip to Australia shut down, and it it became so intertwined that I couldn't keep them separate from each other. The things all seemed to echo each other. And I started writing after I kind of got over a bunch of shock and sadness. I started writing and it was all connected together. And these stories seem to amplify each other. And I sent some of that writing to my agent, or sorry, my editor. And I was like, what do I do? Because these stories that were separate, like what was happening with my daughter and what was happening with the coral reefs, they've come together and I can't separate them again. And my editor was like, this is some of your most powerful writing. And let's find a way to make this work in the story of the book. And so we did. And I think it did work. And I think that finding these connections between things that are largely invisible, mental illness is so invisible. Like if you looked at my daughter, you wouldn't have known how much she was suffering. Like I said, terrestrial creatures, we often just forget about what's happening beneath the waves. But these things are so foundational. Everything rests on our mental health. Everything rests on the coral reef's health in the ocean. And so without them, you know, just like basic survival becomes just nearly impossible. So the stories come together and I hope they amplify each other. And I hope that the emotion of these things that were happening in my personal life help illuminate some of the stories that happen beneath the seas. And that was my goal in trying to share the story this way.
Now, what I found it so powerful is that you're addressing your reader really on a very visceral level, you know, because everybody has issues in their lives, so that nothing exists in a vacuum, isn't it? So if something's happening with the ecosystem, you cannot just take it out of the context.
Correct. Right. And I think we tend to think like ecosystem, well, that's really different from us. But is it so different? You know, and I hope that we start to consider it that way. You know, we are interconnected on this planet together, and the reefs are great for telling us that. I mean, the reefs are the most interconnected, ecosystem that exists, and things depend critically on each other.
So what discoveries in your research for your book, Life on the Rocks, surprised you the most?
I mean, I think the most surprising was this dorky one, which is, well, maybe not dorky, but I mean, you know, I remember I had heard about coral bleaching years ago, 20 years ago, when it was first sort of noticed in the 80s. And I thought, well, surely we've figured out what causes bleaching by now, or at least surely we've discovered like who throws the first switch. Is it the coral or the algae? And the fact that that is still mysterious to us is it blows me away. I mean, I really feel like how could this very basic animal and this very really basic plant hold this mystery away from us for decades of really trying very hard to find out? So when the scientists told me they still don't know, I mean, I was really astonished. It seems like the thing we should know and we don't. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess we write that up to mystery, right? And just there's some human hubris there too. Like, oh, we think we can figure everything out. And this mystery still evades us. So that was one of the most. And then, you know, one of the other cool things is that, and a lot of the book is actually focused on all of the things that we are doing to make coral reefs as healthy as we can as they approach this climate change major stressor that's facing them. And so one of the most amazing things was diving on this reef in Sulawesi, which is in Indonesia, where there has been this incredible restoration project by the Mars Candy Bar Company, which was also surprising. but it's absolutely magnificent. And this, they've restored reef in places where that blast fishing has degraded the reef. And when you dive on these restored reefs, you just, it's astonishing how quickly the coral can come back. Within 18 months of putting in these structures, they call them reef stars, which stabilize the reef. Within 18 months, the reef is full of life and vibrant. And within 3 years, you can't even tell that there's been a restoration at all. So yeah, I mean, I think that's maybe another thing that really surprised me was how resilient coral reefs can be if they're given the proper environment and the things that they need to be healthy. And I guess that's incredibly hopeful.
Yeah. So now we understand the corals and the ecosystems are just so fascinating and just have so much in it. So imagine that you were traveling to some other world that has ocean and it's completely empty. So what kind of coral reef and animals which also live in it would you take with you?
I know this is a really hard question, right? Because part of what makes coral reefs so magical is their incredible diversity, right? And so you'd have to think of taking the seeds for all that diversity with you. And I think it's impossible. You know, how could you imagine taking 250,000 species with you on some sort of rocket ship to another planet? But without that diversity, then the coral reefs are just a pale shadow of what they really are. But if you're going to like pit my feet to the fire, I mean, the species that you'd want to take or the genus that you'd want to take are these coral called Acropora, which seem to be like, which are among the fastest growing coral. They are the kind that seem to be able to become the most diverse, the fastest. There's 128 species in that genus alone. So if you took a few of them, hopefully they could like divide, you know, really proliferate fast. You definitely need to take some herbivore fish with you to eat. Well, maybe you wouldn't have algae, so you wouldn't need the herbivore fish, but I have a feeling the algae would somehow show up somewhere along the way. Yeah, you'd need some big predators. You need some parrotfish. I don't know how you could do it without it. Like, I think there was an effort in the 70s, this thing called Biosphere, where they tried to make a coral reef in the middle of the Arizona desert and the whole thing collapsed. So, you know, maybe that's the lesson, is like, we've got this thing here, you know, we've got this incredibly priceless treasure here on our planet. So let's just take care of it here. You know, trying to recreate it somewhere else seems impossible.
That's it, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just one, we will have one planet, so we need to take care of it.
Yeah. And it's full of so much treasure that I feel like we don't acknowledge how much treasure already lives here. I don't want to go to a dead, dusty, cold planet, you know, like, let's take care of what we've got here. There's so much richness.
Well, this has been a truly fascinating discussion. So can you tell us, what are we currently working on and what will be your next project?
Okay. This is a kind of scary thing for me to say, but what I'm working on now is fiction, which is really like out of my comfort zone. And I never expected to be able to do it, but the story came to me, and I mentioned brief, oh my gosh, I don't know. I'm so sorry. I mentioned briefly that I was, invited to go on this research cruise to do this thing called cloud brightening in Australia. And the idea is that marine clouds are not as bright as clouds over land. And if we could brighten them up a little bit, we could reflect a little more solar radiation to outer space. And underneath those more bright clouds, you can have some local cooling of around a degree or two, which is just what the coral need, right? To escape from coral bleaching. So they were doing this experiment where they were aerosolizing, taking seawater and aerosolizing it and making it letting the salt crystals from seawater float up into the low-lying clouds and basically making those clouds a little more glittery, which reflects sunlight away from the reef. And this idea is kind of remarkable. And there are some scientists who've done some calculations, and they've found that we could actually keep our planet at a degree and a half warming if we were to employ cloud brightening around the world. So the fiction story I'm writing right now is where a 16-year-old girl is just like fed up with the nations of the world not actually taking action on climate change. And she develops a cloud brightener and spreads the idea around the world to these small island nations that are most at risk from climate change. And the planet actually starts to cool. And then the nations of the world take notice and they see this discrepancy between the carbon dioxide coming into the atmosphere and the temperature of the planet starting to fall. And it becomes a little bit of a thriller at that point where everyone's trying to figure out what's happening. And she has to claim her place and say, you know what, you big nations, you don't get to make all the decisions any longer. So it's, yeah, we'll see. I'm pretty far along, actually. I'm hoping to finish it by the end of the summer, and we'll see if I can get it published.
Oh, wow. That sounds super exciting. Cool. I hope you come and talk to us about it when it's done.
Okay. I would love to.
So what's the best way for our listeners to find more information about your work and also your books?
The best place is my website. It is Julie, J-U-L-I, there's no E on it, Berwald, Berwald.com. And so all my information is there, about Spineless, my first book, Life on the Rocks, my second book, and that blog I was even mentioning that I wrote a long time ago. And then I've been doing a lot of speaking, both virtual and in person. So you're welcome to come join me at any of those events, there's reviews, lots of stuff is on there. So julieberwald.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for having me. I'm really delighted to be part of this, and thanks for the great questions. It was a really fun conversation.